Welcome to the Backstory Podcast. I'm your host, Colby Cove. And on today's episode, we have someone who, in his name, is the originator and someone who has his hands on a lot of things that have happened in hip-hop. And as we celebrate the 50 years of hip-hop this year on the Backstory Podcast, please welcome Mr. Jazz-O to the show. What's up, man?
I'm chilling. What's good?
Your story is so interesting because you have a lot of history in the business, but you have a very unique perspective because you were really a part of the early days in hip hop and grew up in Brooklyn, just seeing hip hop being born in New York City and becoming a rhymer yourself. So talk a little bit about just the early days of hip hop growing up and your connection to being an MC and your process to becoming an MC.
It was a time when the type of music was new. So, you know, and I was a young kid. And I was hearing stuff here and there, you know, compared to today, it was pretty, it was very simple, you know, simple lyrics, you know, stuff that, you know, excerpts that were taken from different songs at that time, you know, from old sayings. So everything was basically cliche. It wasn't like how everybody tries to style out now or even, you know, 20, 30 years ago. It was so simple. Also, it was something that was new, you know, like, what is it called? You know, so, you know, the names were simplified, you know, you rhyme it to the beat before, you know, the term MC came, because you were just rhyming to the beat. A DJ was a DJ. And it was rightfully so, because you couldn't really tell the difference between who was a DJ or the MC, because the DJs were doing a lot of the MCing, and that's what it branched from. You know, they took a break and they got some guys who would just be the MC, and they weren't necessarily rhyming. They were just like controlling the party, you know, all the party, you know, to get the crowd excited, like the little crowd pleases, throw your hands in the air, you know, all that type of stuff.
Yep.
And incidentally, I started rhyming on a dare from my guard brother. And, you know, it just went from there. You know, he was impressed. You know, I didn't really care. But he was so impressed, and that was the only thing that had an impression on me. And I was like, let me do it some more. You know, let me write another rhyme. You know, after a while, I started writing rhymes, and the word got out, you know, as it does in the projects. You know, everybody, it's like a small town. Everybody finds out, you know, as soon as you go to the bathroom, everybody knows. So, you know, the word got around. You know, I started rhyming. You know, we had Marcy Center. We had one on each side of the projects. And, you know, I started rolling with, you know, DJs. You know, my first DJ was this guy I went to school with, you know, like a brother from another mother, my man Steve, you know, may he rest in power, along with my god brother, Eric Oliver. So basically, you know, we started KG, DJ Kool KG. He was really the one who spearheaded playing music in the center, you know, like on a Friday. So we all started going down there. You know, this is not me centering the story around me, because this is how it happened. You know, I became like well known because the word got around, like, yo, this dude is good. You know, we don't know what he's saying all the time, but he's good. And I became an attraction. They used to come to Marcy Center to hear me rhyme. People that I went to school with, you know, in elementary school, that found out I do that, you know, they became fans, and it was weird.
Well, your style was different though. So you talk a little bit about your style of rhyming, because at that time you were completely different from any other type of MC. So you definitely would have stood out, because it was just different and it was the early days. But what would you coin the style of rhyming that you were doing?
Back in the beginning, I have to admit I was rhyming like everybody else, because I had to adapt into whatever style I was gonna have. But you know, for the most part, you know, I was rhyming like everybody else, but not like everybody else. I was fortunate enough to be able to insert myself into the skill set and create something new, you know, because I always fashion myself, regardless of anything, to be unique. And I like to be different within, you know, I like to be a quiet different. You know, I wear, you know, I'm the guy in the summer, you know, I'm gonna wear t-shirts and jean shorts and some sneakers, but the way I wear it, you know, you may say like, yeah, okay, that's a little different. So he's quiet different. But that was my thing. But when it came to like, because when I talk about the beginning, you have to understand, I'm talking about the 70s, you know, when I first started rhyming. You know, I first started rhyming, I was still 13 years old. And at 13, you know, these kids, like, they're a little different. At 13, I thought I was a grown-ass man, you know, and I walked around like that. And I played the street like that. And that's just how it is. So basically, when we're talking about the style, it was still the late 70s. There was an incident. I was at KG's crib. This is Cool KG from Marcy, David Gregory. I was at his crib, and he's a DJ, obviously. And, you know, we were like, most of the time, we were making like mixtapes. You know what mixtapes are? You know, you should well know. Mixtapes was like really the tapes, like the cassette tapes. And, you know, we were making tapes. I'd be rhyming for like a half hour, 45 minutes straight. And he's on turntable and he's changing, you know, he's changing beats. And this is all vinyl, just pulling it off and putting it back on. So this ain't like, you know, CDJ and all that other stuff. And we doing all this live. And in the rare incident where there's a mistake, we just start over. And that was something that I don't even recall happening. Because we were on our craft. It was a craft back then. It wasn't, you know, just to style out and impress people like it is today. And I'm not saying there's anything wrong with it. I'm just saying it was different. So I was saying this rhyme that I had written, and I got to this line, and there were too many syllables to fit within a 16th that, you know, as far as the time signature, to fit within that line without it overlapping. And I didn't want to overlap it, because I was coming back in with more words, like on the one of the next bar. So what happened was I doubled it up. I said it faster, yep, than normal. And after we had done the tape and we were listening back, KG kept going back to that same part. And he was like, yo, you should do that more. And I was like, okay. You know, the same thing that happened when I started doing it a little more. I did listen to him. And this was after Jay-Z and I had met, and we started writing stuff together, routines and everything. And, you know, when you hear him talk about the, you know, banging on the kitchen table with the cereal and the Häagen-Dazs ice cream, you know, us being high on sugar and all that, he mentioned the same thing. He was like, yo, you should do that more. And then he started incorporating it more into, you know, into his rhyme style. In 1985, which released in 86, we did a song called HP Gets Busy. And it was with Almond Joy and Easy LD, two brothers who were actually KG's cousins from Long Island, Errol and Jason Ward. In an attempt to make this long story a little shorter, we had done a song called HP Gets Busy, where Jay and I were exhibiting that, you know, just a taste of, you know, what today's is, I call, and for years I coined the triplet style. So then Jay-Z had mentioned, like, later on, this is fast forward to after we came back from London, and, you know, I was opening up for Jody Watley for like 5 weeks, and I was about to start working on my sophomore album. So Jay had mentioned, he was like, we should do a whole song with that style. And I was like, all right. And it was nothing, like, to me, it was just rhyming. It was something I could do. I knew I didn't hear anybody else doing it, but I took it for granted.
Is that where the originator came from? So that style is when you were calling yourself the originator, was that because of the style?
Yeah. And Jay-Z started calling us, and he actually named the song, because we were the beginning of that style of rhyme. He said, we the originators. So that was the name of the song.
So let's go back a little bit, Jazzo. So you grew up in Marcy Projects. That's where you lived at. And you're a few years older than Jay-Z. So Jay-Z was sort of like a kid, and he kind of connected with you. And just talk a little bit about your early days and meeting him, and, you know, what was that? What kind of kid was he in the projects, and what kind of brought you two together?
Well, I was just coming back from dropping out of college in Virginia. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to go to college. I wanted to be an MC. I wanted to be a street guy. So I came back to Brooklyn. I did, you know, I ended up getting, getting the job. You know, I wasn't trying to be the type of street dude, you know, that's just running around doing crime or juxing or anything like that. You know, just the street, you know, that was the street I loved. I loved being outside. I loved being where the action was, you know, just like a lot of us, you know, we weren't trying to, you know, take nothing from nobody and nothing, but we wasn't letting anybody take anything from us. I'm gangster. I'm not a gangster, but I'm gangster. So I came back to Brooklyn. As soon as I got back, I connected with another brother from another mother, my man Nike from the world famous Mighty Shirt Kings. He was, you know, we were longtime affiliates, longtime family, and he was having a conversation. This is what I found out later on. He was having a conversation with some of his neighbors because, you know, Knight lives in the same building that Jay grew up in.
Yep.
Or lived. And they were arguing about who's the best. These are the type of arguments we had. Like, this is like sports talk almost, like,
barbershop. You know, who's
the best. Yeah, who's the best MC in the projects? Who's the best MC in Bed-Stuy? And who's the best in Brooklyn? So they were having one of those conversations. And, you know, Nike was like, you know, like it was two of them besides Nike. And I think they were talking about Jay-Z, who at the time was like Shawnee D or something like that. So, you know, they were, you know, so Nike was like, I heard Jazz just came home. Like, I came home from the joint, but I came home from college.
Yeah.
He was like, Jazz is home. The Jazz is better than everybody. And they were like, oh, we're going to see you, like, set it up. So that's how me and Jay met, you know.
So it was almost like a battle. You guys almost had a battle against each other.
Yeah, it was set up like a battle.
But and, he was a kid, though. He was like
I was a kid.
Younger than you.
Yeah, but yeah. I mean, for all intents and purposes, I mean, looking back, you know, I was a kid.
Correct.
Myself. But he, you know, he was – I mean, as we all found out, you know, he was a prodigy with, you know, an extreme amount of raw talent.
Yeah.
And he was the first individual I ever listened to at that point that I felt had what I had, because I hadn't heard it.
And was he at that moment, like, totally memorizing his rhymes and not writing them down? Was he at that level?
Oh, no, we wrote rhymes. Wrote rhymes. And it was something that I feel both of us had always had the intelligence to do, but we just didn't do it, you know, because that was the thing. The thing was, that was the modus operandi. Mm-hmm. You come up with a thought, you come up with a concept, you go get a pen and a pad or a piece of paper, anything you could write on, and you write a rhyme. That's what, you know, being an MC was, you know. So later on, you know, it became more of a thing, you know, where you do this and you do that, you know, and some people just, they went off the top of their head with a lot of stuff. Me personally, I like to think before I say stuff. So, you know, I was the come up with a thought and write it down. And so was he back then.
So you guys as rappers, starting off with, a battle, you then become friends. Talk about what makes you almost an originator as well was, like, record companies started to pay close attention in that time period. It was a very, very fertile time for rappers. And a major company who had not jumped into rap yet, although all these other companies had jumped into rap, signed you to a deal and then say, hey, man, come to London to record the album. So what was that like for you, like, A, to sign a deal? And what kind of deal was it? What kind of money did you get? And then you're going to London. That must have been like, you know, like mind blowing for a kid from the projects.
Yeah, it was. It was. But I was ready. And I also want to mention that Jay-Z and me meeting, it turned out that it wasn't a battle at all. I mean, I battled. And before I ever met him, you know, I had battled before. And I didn't get anything out of it because I came into battles already knowing that, you know, I know it is what it is. I already went into battles just by knowing or hearing the individual that, like, I'm gonna smash this person. Like, they can't do nothing with me. You know, I don't even have to talk about them. I ain't got to talk about their mother, their sneakers, if they lean in, if they got their last jump shot in them or something. I ain't have to talk about none of that. All I had to do was talk about myself and the way I explain who I am and how great I am. And that's how I did it.
McDonald's is not new to chicken. So maybe stop questioning their chicken cred and get your hands on the McCrispy. Juicy fried chicken, buttery bun, unmatched pickle to chicken ratio. Yeah, they know what they're doing. In fact, we can honestly say they're not new to chicken. They're true to chicken. The McCrispy. Only at McDonald's. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
This label signed you, a major label, signed you to a deal, and then they're like, hey, come to London to record your album. You know, talk a little bit about what made you want to sign with this company and what kind of deal was it? And this was this your first big payday?
Yeah, it was. It was $275,000. And when I saw the contract and I saw the budgets for each, you know, because it was originally... They signed me for 4 albums with 1 irrevocable option to renew. So that technically that meant 5 albums if everything went the way everybody expected. And that was a good deal. And going to London, it was kind of, I felt like that part was kind of corny because, you know, especially around that time, you know, it was 89 and actually it was 88. Hip hop was starting to flourish. With that came the advent of a lot of new studios and some of the more established studios catering to rap artists.
Yeah.
So it was a thing. And I was like, why am I going all the way to London? You know, I could do that right here.
Where the magic is happening, where the people are making all this great music.
Exactly. And it just so happened that I had done the pre-production on just about all of the tracks on my first album in D&D Studios, in which D&D had never done hip hop. They never had a hip hop session, a hip hop oriented set, none of that. Yep. Because Doug Grammer and Dave, they asked my management, it was like, why does this guy need to rent a drum machine, a MIDI keyboard, and a turntable? Because they didn't even have that available. You know, they were doing like bands and stuff like that. So they didn't even have that available. And my management was like, we don't know, just get it for them. So that was like my little MIDI setup. You know, it was an MPC 60, Korg M1 keyboard, and a Technique turntable, and I did the rest. It was exciting going to London, but at the same time, I thought it was corny because once I saw those dollar figures, you know, I was like, okay, let's go. And so in going to London, you know, I asked Jay. Jay was with it.
And Irv Gotti.
Yeah, well, we had just met Irv. And at first, Irv was reluctant. And we don't talk about that. He was reluctant to go. Obviously, he ended up going. And the reason why he ended up going, and a lot of people don't know, so you're getting an exclusive, is that my man KG, I asked him before I was getting ready to, you know, the flights were being set up and everything else. I asked KG, I was like, yo, going to London, record this album. You know what I'm saying? I was basically telling him, nigga, we made it without telling him that. Right, you know what I'm saying? Right, it was like, we made it, let's go.
Right.
And he was like, nah, I'll see you when you get back. I was like,
well, you know, man, what's interesting, and you know, you're not going to say this, but I'll say it. You got probably one of the best deals at that time.
Oh, man, I had the best deal at that time.
Yeah, you had the best deal. Nobody was walking with
you. Yeah, no, I won't hide that. It's nothing to be ashamed of, and it's nothing to, you know, I'm not boasting. I'm telling the truth.
Your label was late to the party, so that's a benefit to you because they saw all the things that were happening. They was like, oh, we got to get a rapper. We got to get a rapper. And so you got the bigger check in that moment. So it's kind of cool for you to get it. When you got the money, what did you do when you got that check? What was one of the first things you did?
Well, I didn't get the check. That was the budget.
The budget. So you had to advance.
They didn't give me, right. They didn't give me $275 here. Do whatever you feel doing.
Right.
You know, it didn't work that way. But I had access to it. So we recorded the album, came back, some of that was attributed to or went to, you know, marketing, all this other stuff.
Yep.
You know, but I was taken care of. You know what I'm saying? I had access. You know, I didn't even have a car yet. But
were you still living you still living in Marcy though, right?
For a second.
Yeah.
For a second, like 3 to 4 weeks after I came back from London, I moved, you know, being a street dude and understanding what type of business situation I was in, I just thought it better that I not be there. I could have stayed and fought all type of wars.
And nobody really knew what the money you made yet anyway. So it was good. There was no internet or nobody to say, you know, Jazzo just signed a $275,000 deal. So you make the album. I had Irv on the podcast last year and he talked a little bit about that experience, first time going to London. And it makes more sense now because at that time in New York, everybody was super tribal. So you guys were Brooklyn guys and he was a Queens guy. So that didn't really happen that way. Like it was literally everybody stuck to their boroughs. So now it makes sense that the two Brooklyn guys take the Queens guy to London. So you come back and the first single that you released from the album is Hawaiian Sophie. We all know it. It was, you know, your first hit song. And then you've got Jay-Z on the song. Talk a little bit about that experience of putting your first song out and how it changed your life.
First off, I didn't want to put out a song like that. I wanted to put out stuff that was more street.
Right.
But I was learning the business. And what I looked at, I saw the executives' enthusiasm and the A&R's enthusiasm with Hawaiian Sophie. You know, there was a novelty song. It'd have a great look for video. You know, telling the story, the vivid colors and all of that stuff, which you ended up seeing.
Yep.
And so I understood that. So I took that hit, you know, saying, look, okay, if y'all going to put this money behind it and y'all going to keep liking me and keep giving me this money, that's not something where I'm like, you know, hanging from a roof or jumping off a bridge or some other idiotic stuff that, you know, people, you know, in some form or fashion have to do to maintain. I'm not doing nothing crazy. I'm just riding the wave. And I made the song. So it's not like it's a song that I was ashamed of. It's just that I would rather have come more street. And that was my thing, to be more street. But every time I opened my mouth, it seemed like it was some R&B or some novelty, you know, in some aspect.
It was an A&R that didn't look like you or me, who thought they knew everything about, you know, music and, you know, were making decisions. And, you know, they didn't know. I mean, that's just the way it is. And then, you know, now you look at it now, artists are way more in tune with what makes sense for them and the labels in most instances stay out of the way. So you have your success as an artist and then you go into, you know, record your second album. What was it like for you as just as an MC in the late 80s as hip hop was really exploding and you trying to find your own lane? Like, what was that like for you?
I had no problem with that part. The thing I had a problem with was EMI having the ability, because back then, because it was before the internet was strong, or before there was really the internet at all, the way we know it, it was difficult dealing with a record company who didn't understand how to market hip hop.
Yeah.
And all the majors, none of the majors really knew. And that's why, like, companies like Warner, you know, they acquired Cold Chillin', they acquired Tommy Boy, you know. So it's like, look.
Yep, CBS acquired Def Jam. Like, they was like, let's grab the people that know what they're doing and, you know, we'll put our machine behind them.
Exactly. Yeah. And EMI was yet to have any of that. Low key, when EMI and Capitol, they had done a couple of separations and coming back together, and this one acquired that one. But low key, they were doing the distribution for a lot of West Coast stuff,
which was just getting started. So it was like literally,
yeah,
what's happening. New York was way ahead of the West Coast, but there was like, and a lot of those artists were very quirky and novelty.
Right. And then also, you know, you had, who was that the NWA was signed to? Was it Priority?
Yeah, Priority. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Capital Distribution.
Yeah. Yeah. But then EMI signs Gangstar like a little bit, I guess, around the time.
Around the same time.
Yeah. So they were figuring it out, but
he
was sort of
they had acquired Chrysalis.
Chrysalis, yeah.
They were actually signed to Chrysalis that was distributed by EMI.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
What I learned about you was that you then kind of got more into the production side of hip hop in the early 90s, which I always call that the Renaissance period of hip hop. That was from 1990 to 96 was just such an explosive time for East Coast hip hop. Talk about your production side, because you started actually doing demos with artists that are now household names, but you were sort of the creative to help put their stuff together. And that was the next part of your career.
The collaborations with Jay-Z, that was the easy part. The difficult part was when I actually started doing that, I had just come back from Atlanta. And it just so happened, the first and only person I could call at that time was Jay. I called Jay. I was like, yo, man, you know, I'm at the airport. You know, I had gotten a night flight and I didn't even have a plan B, you know. So Jay stopped what he was doing, picked me up at the airport. And from there, you know, I had to get it out the mud. I went to the places that I knew. So it's on a creative level, you know, I went to see Dave and Doug at D&D Studios. You know, I was like, hey, where you been? Blah, blah, blah. And I sat down a lot more with Doug and I told Doug, like, yo, this is what I'm doing. This is what I'm setting out to do. And a lot of people don't know this, but when I first got back, this was like 93 or something like that. Mm-hmm. And, there were times that I had to walk from, and I have no shame because I got a lot of pride, but I have no shame about this. I had to walk from D&D Studios, which was 37th Street between 8th and 9th in Manhattan, back to Brooklyn.
Over the Brooklyn Bridge.
Not even over the Brooklyn Bridge. You got to get down from 37th to downtown Manhattan.
Right.
And then get to the east side of Manhattan and then go across the bridge.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, so that was some miles.
At night, late at night.
Yeah, like umpteen o'clock in the morning.
Yeah, New York was a wild place back then, man.
Yo, but I mean, I wasn't worried about that part. The part I was when I had this tan bag with about a stack like this of vinyl, and in the pouch that was in front of it, I had the floppy disks, you know what I'm saying, that I put in, you know, the MPC. So that's what I had, and that's what I carried. I put it on my shoulder, and I get to it. I get back home, and it was rough. That was a rough time, man.
So talk about the demo. So you go to the studio, and then you start working with, I understand you work with the Lox, you work with Mary J. Blige. This is before we even knew who these people were.
Oh, no. Nah. Mary J. was established, and I didn't work with Mary. I think I did a remix that never released on Mary, but Mary and I never worked. I don't, you know, it's the same thing with girls. Like, I don't claim them. If it ain't happened, I don't claim it. But I ran into, and shouts to Mary and shouts to her career. What happened was I would come in contact with so many people because D&D became, and I got to take some credit for that right now. You know, D&D became like the mecca of where you record, because there were studios, and I'm not trying to be funny, I'm just being honest. There were studios that had more experienced engineers, more high-tech equipment, you know, that people could go to, but the prices were reasonable at D&D, and you get that certain sound, you know, that analog, grungy sound. It was
there was an album. They had done an album of D&D at some point.
Yeah, the D&D project. I was on it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I did a song on there called Stone to the Bone. So, yeah, I ran into the Lox album. I met Dave. This is Joaquin and D, Rough Riders. I met D before I met Joaquin. And what happened was they had the A room that was like the top tier room. They had the B room that DJ Premier made famous, because that was his favorite room. And they were building another room that they were going to call the D room, And I always wondered, like, why won't you just call it the C room? You know, and they like, no, this is the D room. So I worked out a situation that I had when, if nobody booked it, in which rarely people booked it because it was still under construction, I could go in there and work out, you know. So I was in there banging out beats and this, that, and other. So incidentally, I started seeing D come in the studio, you know, and I don't know what sessions he was doing, but he heard something that I was doing in that room. In the it was like a pre-pro room, pre-production room. He said, man, he was like, yo, that's hot. He's like, who's that for? And I was like, I'm just making beats. I'm just banging shit out. And he was like, you know, I ain't going to discuss the numbers and all that stuff, but we made an agreement. And so he was like, yo, I got some people coming in. You know, I want to let them hear it. And I guess about five or six minutes later from us talking about that, Styles P and Sheik Lutz came in the room. And they was listening to it. D was like, yo, say something on that. So they start rhyming. And I was like, okay. And he was like, yo, we ain't gonna be bugging you if he say he'd be in like 20 minutes. So like a half hour later, they was like, you know, if it's cool, like you come in too, boo, boo, boo. And I was like, I don't care. And Jada came, he was listening to it, he spit on it, and everybody was digging it. And long story short, we ended up doing a song called For My Niggas that for the life of me, I can't find the cassette. I can't find the 2-inch, the 1/2-inch. I can't find it. I know somebody got it, and I'm gonna get it. But that's how that started. But the first one was, you know, Primo was in there all the time. He was like me, like he. But he was actually working on projects, and I'm working on the project.
And he was cranking out some classic beats in that era too. So we got some gems from Primo during that time.
McDonald's is not new to chicken. So maybe stop questioning their chicken cred and get your hands on the McCrispy. Juicy fried chicken, buttery bun, unmatched pickle to chicken ratio. Yeah, they know what they're doing. In fact, we can honestly say they're not new to chicken. They're true to chicken. The McCrispy. Only at McDonald's. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
Oh, yeah, most definitely. Most definitely.
Not just a gang star, but just in general. He was
in general.
Yeah.
I love Primo beats.
Yeah.
So he stepped in a couple of my, you know, my beat making sessions too. And he was like, yo, man, you'll hear about that later when I get him in front of a camera. But he was, you know, he said like, yo, I got this new group and he wanted to see if they liked this beat that I had. But we ended up doing a song called Forgive My Sins. Mm-hmm. We went on to like doing other things. Primo's management, he contacted me and I started doing songs with other artists from Europe, just started producing. And that was sort of my resurgence, you know. And, you know, Jay heard about it. Jay started listening. We were at a video shoot with Sauce Money for his project. We were around the Manhattan Bridge, and I was, you know, DJ Clark Kent. Every time he see me, he like, I know you got something on you. I know you got a CD. Because that was the thing back then. Like, you ain't no real producer. You ain't trying to get money. You ain't trying to sell no beats if you don't have your stuff on you, to play. Somebody got
that's in New York. Call. You never know who you cross paths with.
Exactly. And you could bet that 8 times out of 10 during your day, if you outside, you're gonna run into people and somebody gonna be looking, especially if they know you got some goods. They're gonna be looking. So he saw me out there and he was like, I know you got something. What you got? So we went in this car and we played this beat in particular. I played him like 3 or 4 beats, I think. And I played him this one in particular, and it became, in my lifetime, the Big Jazz remix. Because when he hears something, he was like Jay's unofficial A&R around that time. And he was like, yo, Jazz got something. So by the time we got around We ended up around 560 State Street, and I was in a car with Jay. He was like, yo, I want this one. He's like, how does it sound to that? And he was saying it's wrong. I was like, that's crazy.
Well, and this was a time when he was sort of still hustling, though, right? Wasn't he hustling at that time?
Man, you ain't going to get me to say nothing like that. If he was, it wasn't.
All right, so, okay. Clark Kent was working at Atlantic, and he had signed Original Flavor, and Jay was on their song. He was on two songs on that album.
Can I Get Open?
Can I Get Open, which was really the triplet, was the first time we heard the triplet sound, you know, with that project. And then that song did actually very well across the country. And then he left to really pursue his own thing with Rockefeller. So talk a little bit. So In My Lifetime was the one where they went to the Caribbean to film the video on the yacht, right?
Yeah, we were actually in St. Thomas.
Yeah, which was for an artist, and I told this to Jay many years ago, for an artist that was not signed to a major label, like he was doing major label, big
budget. It was outlandish.
Yeah, yeah, it was, and that was, they wasn't drinking 40s, they was drinking Cristal on a boat. All the other rappers were posse'd up with dudes with baggy clothes on.
Baggy jeans and Tim.
Yeah, and Jay-Z was way ahead. And I wanted to ask you because, we know he's a mogul, multi-billionaire now. But when I started this podcast 3 years ago, I started with, because I did Jay-Z's pretty much, I interviewed Jay-Z the first 10 years of his career, every project. And when I went back to listen to those interviews, I was like, bro was always like thinking like a mogul. And when I listened to the other interviews with other artists, a lot of artists was just happy to be signed to a major company. And he didn't really want that. So talk a little bit about just the independent spirit. You give him his first record, which we all paid attention to because the video got played on the box. And, so many people like connected with the video because it looked different. Talk about that entrepreneurial spirit. And where did that come from?
I mean, it came from him. And it came from some of the same things that drive others. Just it drove him a lot further, because you look at it, he had to do without certain things coming up as a kid, and he had to get it on his own. Then when you look to the music business, when he was looking, he had linked up, we had all linked up with Dame Dash.
Yep.
And Sauce was kind of wishy-washy in the middle of like being committed.
Dame was with Original Flavor, right? That's how he connected with Dame?
Clark Kent introduced us to Dame Dash.
Okay.
When you look at the dynamics of Jay having music, and at that time Dame was shopping it. He was shopping his music. People were saying like, that ain't going to do it. That ain't going to hit right. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's not that shit, basically. We were standing on the sidelines like, yo, these things is crazy. Like, this is the hottest, shit going. I ain't hear nothing hotter than this.
Yeah.
And, they were like, nah. And from that, that's what motivated him, I feel, to be like, look, we don't need these people. Let's go get it.
Let's do it ourselves.
So fortunately, I think it was Reality Records. It could have been, but I think he ended up on Profile.
All those labels pretty much told him no. And I remember it was Payday. Wasn't he on Payday for like a half a second?
That's what it was Payday.
Yeah, it was Payday. Because it was so many labels like that at that time. It was all these baby labels at that time. But
it was
In My Lifetime was on Payday.
Right. It was Payday, and Dino DeValle, he was reluctant to sign it. And that's no stab against him, but he was reluctant to sign it because he had told me that the agenda around that time was to slow down the influx of what they now call East Coast rap.
Yeah.
And start looking down south. That was the agenda. There was plenty interest, with Jay, but they didn't want to sign it. Partially because they didn't understand. Whatever the reason, I think that was the main motivation for him. Like, look, yo, let's grab some bundles and let's do it ourselves.
So
and
then he worked. You start working on. He puts out Dead Presidents, which again was way ahead of his time. I mean, it definitely was like, what is that when you heard it? And then you worked on Ain't No Nigga, which is really the one song that summer of 96 or spring of 96 that really just was like,
set it off.
Yeah, set it off. And then Def Jam put that on the Nutty Professor soundtrack. So talk a little bit about Ain't No Nigga and that classic beat you flipped for Hov.
It was funny that, I've told this story a few times. He came to me and he had the idea. You know, he had the idea for the sample. And he was, you know, kind of fooling around with the hook, you know. Of course, he didn't know what pitch to, you know, to sing it in and how it was supposed to go. But he understood, like, yo, it should be like a dialogue type of hook, you know, male or female, back and forth. You know, my main concern was the beat itself. So I went to my drum machine and he. You know, he told me, like, yeah, I know anybody can put this together. You can put it together. And I was like, thanks for the vote of confidence. I don't want to let you down. So I went and I sampled it and I was working, putting the drums on top of it. And it wouldn't go because, you know, the sample, seven minutes of funk, it kind of sped up. You know, being this live music, you don't know when that snare is going to hit. It's not going to hit exact anyway. So.
And EPMD used the same sample. For that right. Big hit way back yeah. in the day. It's My Thing.
Yeah.
So we knew what it was, but you flipped it mm-hmm. and added a little something to it.
Yeah. So what I did the opposite. I didn't add anything to it. The engineer that was in the room, we were at D&D, Kieran Walsh, he was like, because I was gonna take a longer time because I still knew how to get the snare on, you know, the sample snare. On top of the sample. You know what I'm saying? I knew how to exactly do that. But he was saying, if you're going to do that, might as well just leave it alone. I was like, yeah, well, can you EQ it to where it's, you know what I'm saying? He was like, yeah. I was like, okay. So I chopped it up into like five or six pieces. And, you know, when you hear the intro, I did boom, ba boom, 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 ba boom, ba boom, ba boom, 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 ba boom, ba boom, boom, boom. You know, because it came in the next one. I couldn't use that intro anymore because when it came back in, if you notice, it doesn't come in on the one like it does with EPMD joint. I do it like how it is on the record, how it goes before the one. So that was that. And I did that. Live on the drum machine pads on the NPC for like 5.5 minutes. And that's what you hear when you listen to Ain't No Nigga, me going boom, 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 boom. And that was it.
McDonald's is not new to chicken. So maybe stop questioning their chicken cred and get your hands on the McCrispy. Juicy fried chicken, buttery bun, unmatched pickle to chicken ratio. Yeah, they know what they're doing. In fact, we can honestly say they're not new to chicken. They're true to chicken. The McCrispy. Only at McDonald's. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
So that comes out, and then, you know, in June of 1996, Reasonable Doubt comes out, and it is an instant success globally. What were you thinking when you saw, because you knew Jay-Z, again, you guys were kids in the projects, not even 10 years earlier, right? And here you are, like, on the precipice of a classic debut album, which every artist would dream of, and at a time in an era where so many artists had that first one was that one. You know, how did it feel? Because that's your guy, you from Marcy, you guys rhymed together, he worked with you on your first project. What did that feel like?
It was fascinating, and it was great. That's all I could say. Like, and I was proud. I was proud because I was proud of the fact that what I set out to do for myself and for him, that it was coming into play. It was coming into a reality that you can see. And I always said it in interviews as far back as I can remember, when they would ask me about Jay-Z, the question that will always come up, and it tells you, it gives you a sign of like the mentality of people. They always ask me, why did you help him like that? Why did you do all this that you did? I was like, yo, are you people human or something? That's what I was saying in my head. I was like, that's what we supposed to do.
Yeah.
When we get up, you know, we bring our people up.
Yeah.
You know, they coming with us.
And you helped them too. You gave them that, trust me, that experience when you got signed to EMI and going to London and being on that album and touring around, that really was an eye-opening experience for him as well about, man, I really want to get into this. I want to do this. I mean, that you offered him that lane. That doesn't really happen for kids in the projects. Like that was a good blessing.
It doesn't happen often, and that doesn't happen often enough. And the times that it does happen, it should be more documented.
Yeah.
It should be documented more, I should say. It doesn't make sense. I didn't understand the question. I was like, what else am I supposed to do? I'm telling y'all, that's my man's. That's like my younger bro. And right. You asking me, why did I help him? It just didn't make sense. And my answer was always, I didn't want him to go through any of the stuff that I had to go through to get exactly to a particular point. And I got to admit, you know, to the level that I did get to, it was rather easy. But the rigors I had to endure from that time on was kind of ridiculous, because I felt like I didn't get a fair shot late. And then I blamed myself later because I felt that I didn't give myself a good enough shot. And I mean, this day and time, I don't think that was true. And it was a time when artists didn't have a say as far as like you communicated through your management, and the management would go to these meetings at the record companies and so on and so forth. It was an unsaid rule. The artist is not permitted in these meetings.
Which is BS. That's all.
Yeah. So like, even though we had the handle and we knew what it was on the street and what the people wanted and everything else, they didn't see it that way. All the administrative stuff, okay, y'all got that. This is what y'all do. But when it comes to the people and what the people want and our skill set and all these other things, these intangibles that you're not really aware of, y'all just looking at the black and red, it's like, we got this. But they didn't respect that back then. You know, now, you know, record labels are at a point where it's like, we just give the artists a whole lot more freedom because they realize like, look, we don't know that part, you know, let them do it, you know, and then the numbers speak for themselves. You know, these guys doing numbers and girls doing numbers. They like, well, whatever they're doing, whatever they're saying, it's working and it makes our job easier.
So for the next couple albums, you then produce a couple of different songs for Jay-Z. Then he comes with his third album, which was, the biggest album he's had to date in my lifetime, Volume 1, which is kind of named after the first song that you did. And then you do Nigga What, Nigga Who.
Yeah, I featured on it. Yeah.
If Reasonable Doubt was a massive success, that album was even bigger. That's what the album that really made him a global artist at that point.
And it boosted Reasonable Doubt.
Yeah, for sure.
I think
sure.
After that, Reasonable Doubt went like double platinum or something like that.
So then after that, you guys have a bit of a falling out, because then he's ascending to an unprecedented stature in hip hop that no one else has ever done. And and then you guys for a while aren't working together. And then you guys come back a couple of years ago after all said and done, and you have sort of a public coming together. So talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, like. And I've said this before, like, you know, people say like, oh, you know, they talk about it as a beef. I'm not the only one that comes from a place like that. But coming from where I come from, beef is you behind a tree. You only got two left in the clip and somebody busting at you. You behind a thin tree. That's beef. What was going on with us was not a beef. It was words passing through people who don't know what's going on. They just want to be, they wanted to be me. They wanted to be the guy that is closest, because I didn't see our relationship that way, because of course it wasn't, you know, but you had people around that they served the function, true enough, but they just wanted to be the man sitting next to the man.
Yeah.
And that's where I was, but I didn't see myself as that. I'm like, yo, I'm his friend. I'm his older brother, you know, spiritually. And that's how it is. You know what I'm saying? He need me, I'm there. When I need him, I feel I can depend on him. And that's what it was. But all of this other politics, and I don't know. You know how it is. It's just like the workplace, you know, people competing and all, you know, just all this ass kissing, ass licking, ring kissing and nonsense. And I didn't want to be a part of it. And that kind of caused me, for his sake, to just like go somewhere else and chill out. You know, I went to sit down somewhere, you know, and do other things, because I wasn't with that. And I knew the only it was going to end up with me doing something to somebody. Instead of me having some type of stupid argument with somebody and them feeling that they could say whatever they want to me, and then, you know, I do what I have to do, not out of anger, but out of like, nah, I got to discipline this individual. I took the high road. You know, I sort of got persecuted for that, because I know a lot of individuals thought, you know, this dude, he being funny, we don't understand him. You know, who would not want to be around during these times? But I think that it was necessary for me to not be around. So when we saw each other again, everything was everything.
Yeah.
Because he understands. He understood. I think if he didn't understand at first, he understood after a while, because, you know, I did plenty of interviews, you know, and people asked me, you know, and they would expect other things. You know, they expect, you know, me to start barking and
feeding the energy. You know, yeah.
Trailing my hands and shit. Yeah. All that shit. So,
well, I'm glad you guys had that moment. I'm glad it was public, and I'm sure you're very proud of him. I mean, you know, he's, you know, I always look at Jay-Z from a different perspective, because I met him when he was in my lifetime, Jay-Z. So I've seen the journey from the beginning. So you've seen it from before that. And it's also it's just a great moment in American history. And it's good to be able to say, hey, man, we watched it, we saw it, and for you really
saw
the beginning of it. Yeah,
American history.
Yeah,
that, it gave me a little chill.
That's
because,
you know,
because it is a part of American history.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it is. I mean, when you think about it. Yeah. Jazz, I want to thank you for your time, man, and glad we had a chance to have this conversation. And you know, appreciate you sharing your insight, and thank you for your contribution to this thing that we all eat off of, man, hip hop. You know, we were kids loving it, and it allowed us to make a living. And you know, you gave a lot to that moment in time, especially when you got signed at a young age, but also even contributing to, you know, some classic albums. So thank you, man. It was great to have this conversation.
All right, thank you. Appreciate your time.
You got it, brother.
Coming up on the next Backstory Podcast, producer and artist and legend, Babyface.
When you did Sunshine with Jay-Z, but what made you choose to do that song? And that was such a great song, a great hook.
To be honest, I wasn't very aware of Jay-Z, but Andre Harrell kind of said, you know, you need to do this guy a favor. He's going to be big, and just do him a favor. I didn't care if he was going to be big. Andre told me to do it, so I ended up doing it. And it was that simple, to be honest.
The Backstory Podcast with Kobe Kolb is an Urban One Incorporated Reach Media Pod Is Good production, hosted and executive produced by yours truly, Kobe Kolb, edited by Donkus. Follow us on Twitter at BackstoryPCC, on Instagram, Get The Backstory. Senior Director of Podcast Operations, Sierra Reed, for Sales and Corporate Partnerships, Josh Romani and Michelle Marino. Digital Marketing, Walter Gaynor, J.R. Smith, and Tim Hall. Thanks again for listening to the Backstory Podcast.